and I'll just.
You kindly lead your discussion.
Okay, I will.
What you want to talk about?
I'll just set this here. And my name's Jonathan Garland, and I'm visiting with Mr. Gaston Meadows here at his home. Today is April 11th, 2005. And Mr. Meadows, if you could you just tell me when and where you were born?
I was born right in Angelina County, just out of Lufkin, back when we still had home deliveries. July the 24th, 1920.
And who was your mother and father?
My father was Tom Meadows. My mother was Ethel McCoy Meadows. She was a McCoy and a Nearing. Well-known families all over Angelina County now.
What did your father do for a living?
He farmed in my early part of my life there. That was back during the Depression that you wouldn't know about. Born in 1920, the crash of 28 and 29 there was pretty severe. But living on the farm, we had plenty to eat, few ragged clothes to wear, and didn't know the difference what we was living real good.
About where the farm, where was the farm located?
Out east of Lufkin in the Moffitt community.
The Moffitt community.
That's where I was raised.
Did you go to the Moffitt school?
I did. Until the high school was transferred to Lufkin, like I believe in 1937. Played basketball on the team out there. That's about the only sports that we had. That's a little baseball, but it wasn't organized stuff. Lots of people in Angelina County remember the log gym that we had built out of logs. Lasted there for several years. First year we had it, we won the county championship in Angelina County. Beating Savala for it by 1 point. Right here in Chandler Gym in Lufkin.
Did you play basketball?
I did. Mm-hmm. I played 1 year for Lufkin after transferred up here.
Mm-hmm. What year did you graduate?
1939.
39, okay. And I know you started working for the railroad in 42, you told me. What brought you to the railroad?
Jobs were pretty serious when we come out of high school. I worked for Mr. Ed Hallman, Ruby Cafe there, waiting tables, serving.
I'm sorry, where was I at?
Ruby Cafe.
Ruby Cafe.
One of the oldest and best restaurants in Lufkin at that time. Later worked for Spirit Dairy a little while. Married my wife, Jackie King. During that time, she was working at the Eat-A-Bite, a drive-in restaurant across the street there on the corner of First and Frank. Shortly after we married, we leased the Eat-A-Bite up on North First with Mr. Griffith. And we ran that about a year and a half, or about a year before the war started. Rations started there and made things pretty short for small businesses. Lots of the railroad men ate with me when I worked at the Ruby, and several of them when we had to eat a bite up there. And getting to know them, they encouraged me. I was thinking about getting out of the restaurant business. They encouraged me to go to work for the railroad, and I did. Mm-hmm. January 42.
January 42.
She ran the Eat-A-Bite restaurant there for about 2 months after I went to railroad with what help she could get, and let the lease go back to Mr. Griffin. He took back the money. We moved to Shreveport there and stayed about 3 or 4 months. I was on midnight switching and up there. Before I could, you know, we worked seniority on the railroad strictly. Before I could hold a job out of Lufkin. Come back to Lufkin then as soon as I could hold a job there. And
So what did you do at Shreveport?
I was a fireman on the switch engine there.
On the switch engine, and okay,
midnight. on a midnight job. And,
switching the Shreveport yards.
Switch there in the yard, right on the bank of the Red River.
Any interesting stories or characters from your first couple months of working, or that you can recall?
Lots of interesting characters. Some of them I wouldn't want to talk about too much, okay. But for the most part, I was raised up to work all my life, and as long as you did your work and tried to do the best you could, most of the engineers all liked you if you did that. I didn't mind working. I got along good with all of them. In our work, we all have some favorite people that we like to work with. I did that. We go back to other fellows. I had to move back to Lufkin. We lived in a little apartment up on North First, corner Fred and North First there. And there was about three or four of my favorite engineers that lived right down Fred Street there behind me. And the name of V.B. Scott, one of the oldest from there. Connie Nunn, George Porath.
What was that last name?
George Porath.
Porath.
He was a Swede, being tall Swede, about 6 foot six, fine fellow.
He was an engineer?
Yeah.
When you were?
You might remember some of his stepchildren here. He married a woman with three or four kids there. Durwood Witherspoon was an insurance business here in Lufkin. And that's one of his stepchildren. Had another one named Lamar. Worked for Moore Grocery Company down there for several years.
And then, so after about two or three months, then you got to come back to Lufkin.
And, you know, the World War II was going on. I was in the draft age. Got two or three deferments. The railroad did for me. I didn't ask for them. The railroad got them. In the latter part of 43, I was in the military service. Stayed in the Pacific then for almost 2 years. Once I finished basic training, was discharged in February 1946.
What did you do in the Pacific?
I was in the 7th Division, 17th Infantry. Fighting Japs from one island to the other. Philippines, Saipan, and Okinawa. Took about a month off after coming back out of the service and went back to the railroad, went to work. Stayed right there until 1982. I was promoted to engineer there then, I think, in 1947. Of course, you stay on as a fireman there until they need you as an engineer. In the meantime, they started the diesel electric service in place of the steam engine, which was a lot more freight and did it more economically at the time. Being a young person there, the diesels wasn't too hard for me to transfer over to. It was a lot worse on the old people. Kind of like computers today. Mm-hmm. The young people learn how to use a computer and use them a lot easier than older people do. And it worked the same way, transferring from steam power to diesel electric.
Before we talk a little bit about that transition, can you tell me a little bit more about the days of steam? What you remember about that? Maybe some of the engines, the class of engines that you ran. Were you in freight service and passenger service? Or?
Freight and passenger both. Of course, the passenger jobs, longer mileage. On the passenger train, you worked from Houston to Shreveport all the way. On the freight job, you had a terminal here in Lufkin that you traded off, mm-hmm. exchanged on. When I could, I worked between Lufkin and Shreveport to go practically all the time when I could because you were homeward.
What would a typical day's work be as a passenger engineer?
Typical day's work on a passenger train started out about 8:30 in the morning, and you ended up in Shreveport and through with the engine inspection and everything, probably around 4:30, all pretty close to 8 hours. The night trains, which...
So you'd leave Lufkin at 8:30?
No, you'd leave Houston.
Okay.
So the passenger trains run all the way
right,
through.
Okay.
It didn't change.
So you were actually based in Houston then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Based in Houston, but a lot of the time I stayed here in Lufkin. The evening passenger train come through here about 12:30, 1 o'clock, going to Houston. I would catch it, ride to Houston, get ready to go to work at night at 10 o'clock on the night train, coming back when I work the night train. Take back all the way to Shreveport, leave Shreveport back at night about 11 o'clock in Houston. Eat breakfast, change clothes, catch the day train back to Lufkin, get off. And I would be here about 26 hours.
Okay.
I didn't be at home that much, about 26 hours.
So your job then was going from Houston to Shreveport and Shreveport back to Houston?
I was just what they call deadhead from Houston back. But I lived in Houston about 2 years during that time.
And those were trains 25 and 26?
25 and 26 was the day train. 27, 28 was a night train.
And what locomotives did you run in the days of steam on those passenger trains?
In the steam engines, when I first went to work, we had mostly the 900s, which we called the F1s. And they had an 800 class engine, I believe they called them C5, I'm not sure what they were.
Y'all ran those on passenger trains?
No, the 800 was a freight locomotive.
And the 900 was also, wasn't it?
Yes. The 800 and 900 were freight locomotives.
Right.
They went up into the larger numbers of the 900s, which you called an F5, if I can hear. They was a little larger freight engine than the F1s were. The F1s, we liked those engines. They was good freight engines, wasn't it?
Those had 10 drivers, didn't they?
Yeah. 10 drivers, so did the F5s have 10 drivers. In the passenger service, they run three different classes there. They had what they call the T6, T9, P13. P6 engines run from 600, I believe, to about 610, 12. But that was the smaller engine that they used over here most of the time. They would run some P5s, which run up from about 612 to 630, something like that. And the P13s was on up a little higher numbers. All of those that you got higher was a little larger engine.
What did you have any preference of those particular engines? Which ones did you like? Did you have a favorite?
I liked the little P6 engines. They was good riding engines and didn't handle big trains over here. On the night job, which I, the only one I could hold most of the time there when I was a fireman. They rode real good. Was just a nice little engine for the side train we had. Mm-hmm. Anywhere to 6 to 9 cars.
6 to 9 cars.
Would be about the largest train you handle on them at night.
What about the day trains? How many cars were those?
Day trains were 3 and 4 cars.
Just 3 and 4. Was the night trains with a lot of that mail cars? Or?
Yeah, more mail cars, and you had a sleeper pullman on the night car too. You had an extra mail and baggage car on the night train and a pullman and a sleeper train.
And then on the freight engines, you like those pretty well? Or?
I like the 900, the F1 class that we had. They were good riding engine. Didn't handle quite as big a train, but back in the freight days there, steam engine days, we had two hills between here and Freeport. We're right out in Nacogdoches, one called Church Hill, and then just before you go into Garrison, one called Fitchy Hill. A lot of times we had to double those hills with a train. What we call it doubling is more than you can pull. And you just cut it half in two and carried half of it up there. Come back, got the other half, put it together, and left again. Sometimes you had to double both of those hills someday. And going and coming.
Church Hill and?
Church and Fitzy.
Fitzy, F-I-T-Z.
That's just this side of Garrison. Mm-hmm. On the highway there, you'll notice a pretty good hill there on the highway, part of it. The railroad track was over just east of the highway, all the way from right out of Nacogdoches up to Garrison.
Any particular stories that you can recall from those steam days? Anything unusual that happened? Certain runs, a special run, or anything like that?
There was something unusual that happened on a run any day of the week. That's one thing about railroad. You go up and down the same track, but you work every day. It's a little different. There's no train that handles the same way. Not one of them that you do exactly the same way every day. You have to kind of judge what you got and handle it accordingly.
At what point could you tell, you know, through experience, of course, you would know, but, since you mentioned that each train was different, but after a certain point that you knew what you had and knew what you needed to do to make a certain bend or hill, or about how long would it take you to get a good feel for it?
Well, it took different time for different people. Of course, that happens in every kind of work that you do, you realize that. Some of the older engineers that I worked with, by the time they got to the Angelina River, they knew what kind of train they had and how they was going to have to handle it. Some it took a little longer, but the majority, they knew what they were doing. Now, when we was handling 35 to 50 cars back in the steam engine days.
On the freight train?
On the freight trains. When you went to diesel, it was much different.
What all kind of loads did you carry?
The engineer didn't know about everything that he had back there in those cars. We handled any kind of freight that you put out there. Mm-hmm. We run some trains back those days. It was all what we call PFE, refrigerated cars.
Is that Pacific Fruit Express
out of the valley. I have seen them run 5 and 6 of those trains out here in the morning. That was your train you called 144. It was going east, that is from Houston to Freeport. At the time when the vegetable business was good down that way, well, they'd run 45 sections of those trains, solid PFEs. Mm-hmm. Which at that time had a compartment on each end of the car that had ice in it. Later those cars had their own refrigerating unit on it that cooled that car, which they still use. You see a lot of those cars. Not a lot of them this day and time come to here, but they've got a unit, refrigerating unit somewhere that cools the entire car when they haul something like that. As you notice there now, lots of it is tank cars. All of those are not gas nor what chemicals, lots of chemicals is handled out of the Gulf Coast down there. You're aware of that? One of them blew up down there a couple of weeks ago. And some of those trains, if you had a wreck with them, would do the same thing out here on the railroad.
Anything you remember specifically about those last days of, course now we're getting into some of the diesel era, but the last days of passenger service, were you running passenger trains in those very last days, the last few months and weeks?
I never did a whole regular job as running. We called a running as being the engineer. I was a fireman most of the time.
Oh, okay.
I was engineer in emergency. Engineer laid off, and I was promoted engineer and qualified at the time I was firing on passenger fire. You had to have so many years in service before you were qualified to operate passenger. Okay. But I caught my own job that one night and was the engineer on it. And I was a new fireman, but I was the engineer on it back in the steam engine days. Mm-hmm. That's the only one trip that I made as an engineer on the steam passenger.
And was it to Shreveport or to Houston?
Shreveport to Houston and back. And when back. You wrote one way, you took the next train back. Okay. You made a round trip.
Made a round trip. But I guess they had converted to diesel by the late 40s, huh?
Well, I believe it's up in the 50s now.
Early 50s.
They started with using some switch engines in the yard on diesel, I believe, pretty soon after I come back out of military service. That's where they started first with the diesel, was in the yard engine, before they went to road engine. Then they used them first out on the West Coast, California area out in there. As they acquired more diesels, they come west. And I guess it was in the late 50s before they completely all these were. It might have been the early 60s. I'm not sure.
I think the passenger trains, though, they were diesel by the last days, though, weren't they?
Yes.
54 and 55, I believe.
I expect it was. Started on about then. They had a smaller engine. They were passenger-built engine. Had a little steam generator in the nose of them there, because you knew you had to furnish heat on them trains, on your passenger cars back there, heating and cooling both. And you had a steam generator there in the front of them that you fired up and to heat your cars with them back there on passenger train. It's a smaller engine, 2-something, I forget the number of them, and don't remember the class. But I worked with several engineers there on them. They'd run it halfway and I'd run it the other half as their fireman, just helping them out.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to be a fireman on a diesel?
Well, you had to keep the engine in operation. Like I said, you had a steam boiler there that you had to take care of too. And that engine sticks out there in front of you, and that engineer can only see down one side of that roof. And you're his eyes on the other side. There's a lot that takes place on both sides of that railroad.
You're talking about the high nose,
yeah.
More like the freight units, huh?
Yeah, like the freight ones, and that's what they were at that time. It was much as a safety precaution as anything, because you know something can happen to one person at any time up there by itself. Mm-hmm. And they're operating some of them today with just one man up there, but now there's two there most of the time, because your conductor rides up there all the time now, where there's just two people that come in. You've got two sets of eyes, but altogether they're different. I haven't had to operate them. Now, we operated before I retired quite a bit without a fireman. But when you did, the brakeman or conductor was up there and hit him at the same time.
I know you commented a little bit about the transition to diesel, about some of the older fellas had a harder time making the transition, but anything, can you say something specific, more specifically about maybe the first time that you and your coworkers started seeing diesels? You know, what was the thought and the idea about, you know, this new technology coming?
We look forward to it. Okay. We look forward to it. It was going to be a challenge. It was going to be a much easier work than condition, a lot cleaner, cooler working condition. When you was on the steam engine there, you had a big fire in that firebox. You was burning oil. It was nasty. You was having to stop 2 and 3 times on every trip to take a tank of water. And you had to send out the flue. All that was nasty in that fire, and it was hot. I sat down on that engine down there at your place the other day and looked down at that firebox and said, how do we stand this back in July and August? You had a tremendous fire in that firebox. Mm-hmm.
It was nice during the winter time, but not during the summer. Huh?
Yeah. Well, they even put air conditioning on this diesel. I don't know whether TSC had any of this air conditioning or not. Whether they had ours, these smaller jobs, but those big freight engines there, they put air conditioners on them. About half the time they wasn't working, but they had air conditioning on them, and it made a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. Back in the steam engine days, we all wore overalls, blue shirts, and jumpers, and what have you. We got the diesels there. I'd have to bring clothes just like I got on right now, and we didn't have a lot of these at that time, unless it was khaki clothes. I would wear a lot of clothes that I took to the cleaners there and had them clean. You wear them clothes today, or hang them up, wear them again a couple of days there. You didn't get dirty and nasty like we did on steam engines there. Started out with pretty clean clothes on, ended up the same way.
I've heard some stories about how dirty some of those engineers and firemen would get working
would.
On those steam engines.
It depended on what happened on your trip. Mm-hmm. You had to cope with whatever happened, because when you left here, you was expected to get that train to the next terminal. That's what your job was, safely.
And on time.
Well, a lot of that on time stuff was for the books. For a passenger train was supposed to run on time, in which they did pretty well. But they could get delayed too. Freight trains, they run them when they got the freight ready. I was just liable to go to work at 2 o'clock in the morning, as I was at 8, at 1 o'clock at night, 3 or 4 in the morning. We worked in what they called a pool. We regulated the number of crews you had according to how they worked. We made just about every day. We tried to keep them regulated, and you worked in a pool. And if they run some extra trains, you got in and out a little faster. We worked with a mileage agreement too. 3,800 miles was the maximum miles that a person was supposed to make. We laid off and let the extra board work. They came in on the extra board there just to do the extra work. And when they had the occasion, we worked 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And people can't work all that much. When I went to railroading, we worked 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and didn't even get a vacation. When I was railroading in 1942, didn't even get a vacation. They signed the agreement about the time that I went in military service. So many years, I believe it's 5 years, you got a week vacation. I was in Camp Walter, Texas, my basic training there. Got a weekend pass there, and we come to Lufkin. I had a week's paid vacation, a check waiting for me here. That's more money than I'd seen in 3 or 4 months at that time. But when I retired in 82, I was getting 5 weeks vacation. Of course, I expect people working down that dive bar were getting vacation at that time too, in 1942. And then they got a great vacation.
I don't think so.
I believe it was 30 years service qualified you for the maximum of 5 weeks vacation. I got that about the last 12 years of the work, 11 years of the work.
So if you needed a day off, you would just go and ask your supervisor if you could have a day off, and it was just granted but without pay.
Granted without pay. What you said, won't lay off, I've got to do so and so. That's fine. We can put him in on next year.
Go to a funeral or doctor, take a family member somewhere, something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. If you wanted time off, you had to lay off. And it was still like that when I retired. Of course, talk about having a regular job. You had a regular job on the pool, but you liable to go to work today at 4 o'clock. Tomorrow you're liable to go to work at 8 the next night. Wasn't like these log roads. They had a set time that they went to work every morning. Of course, they might work a little later if they didn't get the train back in there. They went out in the woods and got a load of logs and brought them back. I watched those trains, the TSC. Mm-hmm. They operated on our track from Diebold there down to... I can't remember what the name of that switch is. Just beyond where that farm road crosses the track there, top of the hill across the river. Guess what that switch was? They went out to Acall. Okay. That track that run out there.
Yeah, Acall, now that would be the Angelina County Lumber Company.
Yeah, that's what that was. Diebold had one out there somewhere they went to. But A&R operated down there too. And over across the river in Nacogdoches County. Operating on our track.
Do you remember, I think it was the 110, Angelina County Lumber Company's engine that's at the zoo now that ran, I think, from Potomac.
Yeah, that was the name of the siding down there.
Yeah. Was that where the switch was that went to Acall?
Yeah.
Potomac, okay.
Well, there was a sidetrack there, too, and then they had a switch that went out to the woods out there to Acall.
That was in the late 50s, I think, wasn't it?
They didn't run them any after that, I don't know. Okay.
But you remember, maybe it was even earlier than the late 50s, but did you actually see them? Or
oh, yeah.
Did you see them?
They might be in the sidetrack down there waiting for us. They had to have train order.
Right.
On our railroad door to operate from Potomac to Lefton.
And
the same way, I forget the little switch over across the river in Nacogdoches County. They used that over there some. Mm-hmm. And that was their railroad out with the paper mill. That's the reason. Right. Mr. Kirkland, that's the reason that paper mill was built on the railroad out there.
Did you know if any of those guys that were engineers for the Angelina County Lumber Company or Angelina Nature River?
Yeah, I knew them at that time, but I can't give you no name. Okay. Now. It was fellow Brookshire. And it was Brookshire, the engineer on the air, and was hard out there a long time. Well, Jay Marshall, mm-hmm. come up here and went to work then. But Jay, I believe, was a conductor on there when he come up here and went to work then.
He started in 56.
He wasn't running the engine, was he? I think he was a conductor after he come up
he
here.
He ran it some, but I know he was conductor mm-hmm. for a long time, too.
Jay started out, I tell you about him working. A friend of mine, daddy down at New Willard, who worked for the what lumber company?
Thompson? Down Thompson Tucker or
Texas Longleaf lumber company, it was. That's where Jay first went to work. And a good friend of mine that worked over here on the SP coming down there. He first started out down there firing for his daddy there at New Willard. They done the work on their engine. He says his daddy had to tie that engine down every Sunday. Of course, that was back in his early days. He was trying to court. His daddy made him go out there and help him work on that engine. They started out down there at New Willard there, which I think was a long way from workmen. S.S. Barnett, I believe it was. Bud Barnett, they called him.
Do you remember the MC&SA coming into Moscow there?
Yeah. We'd set out cars there and pick up cars that they brought in. They allowed me sitting there waiting for them. I told them that's the only real road I knew that the State Highway Department would build them overpass on their track if they didn't run but one train a day over. They still operate down there, don't they?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, we had a little railroad too. They come in from somewhere into Livingston. WBTNS.
Oh, yeah, Waco, Beaumont, Trinity, and Sabine. Yeah. You remember when it ran, huh?
Yeah. Well, that wasn't what we called it, but I'm pretty...
Wobbly, bobbly, turnover, and stop.
Now, yeah. That's what we called it there. You had the correct name.
What do you remember about that?
I just remember it coming in there is all.
Do you remember that for a while they ran a... I think it was an old 32 model Model A car with flange wheels on it, and they had a little homemade trailer that they pulled behind it.
What was it doing, carrying mail?
In the 40s. Well, they carried passengers.
They did.
And mail as well. Did you ever see that?
I never did see that. Now, I've ridden on one of them. They have one down there. They call it. A good friend of mine that's around here and not in very good shape right now, MacMullen, Julius MacMullen, Jack MacMullen. You knew Jack, or Jack hid the A&R up out there for a long time, and his son did it after him. Julius was his older brother. And Julius's daddy run the A-Call camp down there. He run the store out there, handled all the business for long time. He had a little shack down there that he lived in. Julius, another friend of ours, we went down there one Saturday afternoon and spent the night at his camp. They took us in that, I think it was no Model T, might have been a Model A or something, but we rode that from where the camp was down in the river bottom. The next morning went hunting down there. And I rode that down the bottom and back.
And then, now, was that at the A-Call in Polk County?
That was the A-Call.
In Polk County? Okay. Because they moved the camp around at different times.
Well, it was...
That's where it last located.
It was straight out in there and part of what is the paper, what they call the paper mill pasture.
Okay.
That's where it was.
Let's see. You retired in 82. Can you talk? We talked about the diesels and things like that. Any other changes in your railroading career that you can comment on? Just changes in the way the railroad did business. That's 41 years, you said, right? That you worked there.
Your big changes was when the diesels first came here. There was all these big old cab overs that you seen, which I forget what we did call them anyway. All the same size all the way through.
The bullnose front?
Yeah.
Yeah, the cab.
That's what they used, and they used mostly three units on them. Each unit on the head end was called A units. The one in the middle with no cab on it was the B units. And you could operate them three or four, or one or two, either way you wanted to. When they went to the other style engines, which they got larger, the largest freight, when they started out with those engines, they were 1,500 horsepower. When I retired, we was running engines 3,600 horsepower. That's how much larger they got. course, we talk about them as diesel tower, but you just had a big diesel engine in there that run a generator. Mm-hmm. The power was all electric.
What about your three-axle units and the two-axle units? Y'all are all running two-axle, I guess.
The older ones, the first ones you got, was all two-axle units. As they got larger, they went to three-axle. I think that's about the most that I noticed in the end there. And each one of those axles now had a traction motor around it. That's where your power was. We called them traction motors. There was one around each axle, then there was a gearbox on every axle there. Each one was separate power. But all your power was coming from the same main generator.
Besides the locomotives, what would be some of the big changes in railroading that you would say are some fairly big changes? What about the piggyback? Did y'all do much of that?
Piggybacking started off very slow in this part of the country. It was trailer on flats is what they were called, TOFs, I believe. From that, they went to handling lots of automobiles. But the automobiles had a regular rack car that was built for it. Now, I can remember when we hauled automobiles in boxcars. But they had racks built in boxcars, and you might have seen some of them. You had a special ramp built there where they could unload those, and it'd probably take them all day. Ford Motor Company, General Motors, wherever the company, probably take them all day to unload four cars out in box cars. If they started building those automobile racks, they drove them up on there and drove them off. Mm-hmm. That's how long it take to load them. The first one come out, I think the cars had about six on it. Six automobiles on it. I haven't paid any attention to them now, but they was handling 9, 12 automobiles on all the cars when I retired. That's how much progress it was making. We was handling lots of container cars, which was shipped from foreign countries by boat and barge and what have you. That was lifted up the car and just set on those flat cars. I forget just what they did call them, but they built a regular yard where they could load and unload those out in port down there. Port of Houston handled a lot of them in there. You've got a lot going to the West Coast and coming away from there. They could, and not just from boats and stuff, a lot of your industry started shipping freight like that too. Mm-hmm. They could ship that to a merchant here in Lufkin or anywhere else. And one of those containers, they used to stack four, I believe, of those on a flat car. And they were tied down, strapped down. Maybe one of those containers went to one manufacturer, another container went to another. There'd be four or five different merchants or manufacturing plants that got a container off of that one car, which made it much more efficient for the shipper and for the merchant handling it there. A lot of the business that the truck was handling.
What about communications, the radio? What kind of impact did that have?
Well, that was just as much different as setting your TV there and you watching your program than it was you're listening to it on the radio.
When did y'all start using radio?
Oh, I can't give you an exact date on that. I can for the last 10, 12 years that I worked, and say from 72 to 82, first started out you had radios on the engine. you can communicate from one train to the other train. Then they put one on the caboose that operated in the generator that operated off of the axle, that you can communicate from the head end to the rear end of your train. Then they got the walkie-talkies that a brakeman, conductor, whatever, if something happened in your train, he had to walk it to find out what it was in your train there. He had a walkie-talkie with him. When he found it, he could tell you what he had. If you got to cut a car loose and take it somewhere and set it out, you can do it right there without him having to come back up there and tell you what we're going to do. In the same way, a flagman, you know, when that train stops out there on the main line, there's another train somewhere behind you. The flagman has to go out to check the rear end of that train to keep one of them from running over the other. The block signals take care of a lot of that, but they didn't have block signals all the way. We had block signals from left in the garrison. From this hill, where the hills are bad, that's all we had when I was working. I expect they got them all the way now, but I'm not sure. But they operated control and dispatchers. You had to have train orders for. They operate them now, I think, strictly by radio. I think they all operated that way. Your dispatcher can communicate with the train crew at any time, any place. It was a great step in the railroad industry, radio. Just like it is in the military there. Commander can talk to his men out there on the front lines. Then what they're doing there now is just that much help as it was on the railroad.
You were talking about the number of cars that the steam freight trains had, 35 to 50. What was a, again, typical, you know, I realize